Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to the Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we do indeed unpack three big questions from Sunday's message. On Sunday, we continued in our series in Romans. We're looking at the second section as we work our way backwards through the text, looking at chapters 9 through 11, where Paul is addressing a fairly critical issue for the pastoral concern that he is addressing, which is who is included in the people of God and on what basis. And if the first section, which we looked at last week, was denying that that inclusion was based on ethnic or racial or biological grounds, in the second section, which takes up most of chapter 10, Paul deals with the question of, is inclusion into the people of God based on obedience or faithfulness to the law, and particularly the law of Moses? And he denies that it is, and that becomes a fairly significant and big piece in the midst of it. There's a shift in the language in the first part of chapter 9 when Paul is addressing, you know, the ethnic and racial inclusion. He leans heavily on God's elective choice to show mercy to and include in the promises some and not others. That's where he sits. That's where a lot of that argument sits. When he turns to the law, the emphasis then turns really to, as he concludes in that section, on professing with our mouth that Jesus is Lord and believing in our heart that God raised him from the dead. And so there's this kind of interesting combination of ideas around God's elective purposes, around our choices, and then particularly as well around the question of the law of Moses and how that sits for us. And so the questions reflect some of that. So here we go. Here are the three questions we'll be looking at today. How can we best reconcile our responsibility to hear and believe with God's sovereign election and predestination of those who will be saved? So we'll deal a bit with that. That question, I think it's interesting because I think the Romans passages that we're dealing with are not necessarily about individual salvation. And so we do have to ask some big questions about how we can utilize Romans 9 and 10, for instance, in a conversation that it was not designed for. But we'll have a crack at that. Secondly, Paul says in Galatians 3:24 that the law is a schoolmaster that brings us to Christ. What is our correct use of the law according to Paul? And that's, again, a big systematic question, right? Because Paul ends up addressing the law on several occasions for several reasons, and combining all that he has to say is quite a task. I will not attempt it today, but I'll give some broad categories, I think, that we should be thinking about the law from the perspective of Paul. And then third, a little bit more in terms of the application part. In today's context, how can we live our faith when we need to take into effect the law? And I'm going to assume that that's take into account the law, and that the law is not the law of Moses, but the general law of the land. So that's how I'm going to take that. I don't know if that's how it was meant. So if it wasn't, I apologize. And we'll have to try again at another point in time. But let's get stuck in. So the first question is one that we have addressed from time to time on the Big Three. Several years ago now, I think we did we used to call them the fourth question, and we would just deal with one issue for the entire episode, and we did a fourth question on predestination. Someone reminded me about that the other week. So we come around to this every so often, and I think appropriately so. It's a pretty big question for us. How can we best reconcile our responsibility of hearing and believing with God's sovereign election and predestination of those who will be saved? Now, as I said very briefly in the introduction, I think that one of the things we have to pay attention to when Paul, for instance, uses language of election and predestination and whatnot, is that we need to pay attention to the context in which he is using that language. One of the things that that theologians do, because this is how theology works, is they systematize theology. And so they, you know, they comb through the Gospels and they comb through the New Testament epistles and they comb through the Old Testament in all of its different types of literary forms. And they pull out the things that the Bible has to say about God's sovereignty, about his election, his choices that he makes, the basis of those choices, what it means to be saved, pulls them all together and then tries to systematize them under certain headings, which is a really valuable and excellent practice, right? It's really helpful. It's, you know, if you ever have the opportunity to study theology or to read about a doctrine, what you will encounter is a systematic approach to that, almost inevitably, which is really helpful. The difficulty, though, is that if we take all of the systematic theology, right, kind of if we try to take all that we know about a particular topic and apply all that we know to every time one of the kind of trigger words shows up, we can end up doing some disservice to the text that we are looking at. So, as I said at the outset, in chapters 9 through 11 of Romans, Paul is not really addressing the question of who is or is not saved. He's not talking about that, which I answered a little bit last week, or reflected on last week. But he's talking about who's included in the people of God. And so that's a really important consideration. And so whenever you come across this language in texts, it is worth asking what part of the systematic universe, right? You know, what part of everything that we could say about this particular topic is actually being reflected here? So I think that's helpful. However, the question is quite broad, and the question is a little bit more systematic than it is based in Romans. All right, so how can we best reconcile our responsibility to hear and believe and God's sovereign election and predestination of those who be saved? How can we best reconcile? I don't know. Well, I think the best way that we can reconcile our human responsibility to make choices and God's sovereign election, the best way that we can reconcile them, I think, so this is my personal opinion, is by holding them in tension. I think we have to hold them in tension. I'm uncomfortable with either of those options on their own. So the idea that God has before time predetermined all who will be saved, and therefore predetermined all who will not be saved, and that there is absolutely no choice that we get to make that significantly or in any way impacts or changes God's will. It has already been predetermined. I'm really uncomfortable with that. I think I'm uncomfortable with it for a variety of reasons. I think from a pastoral perspective, it's just a nightmare. You know, how can I tell you that you are indeed saved when I really don't know? I can't tell until we get to glory and I find out if God chose you or didn't choose you. Now, I can say that I can look and say there's some fruit in your life, but I can't categorically say that you have been chosen. It's hidden in the will of God. That is super, super difficult from a pastoral perspective to give people any kind of confidence. I think it creates a nihilistic discipleship, right? Well, what does it matter? I'm chosen or I'm not chosen, so I'm going to live my life. And if I'm chosen, then great. If I'm not, then too bad. Now, it doesn't always lead that way. right? But I think it's really problematic. I think it's hard to encourage people to pray for people that they know in their families or in their friendship circles who aren't Christians. Because, you know, well, it's God's choice. So that's all there is to it. And maybe God chose them and maybe he didn't. I think that there are all sorts of pastoral implications. So I struggle with that. I also think, and this is, I think, maybe more significant from my perspective, is I don't think it doesn't really sit with the way Scripture talks about it. Like, Scripture does affirm that God is sovereign and that God makes choices and that there are choices that God has made before the creation of the world, right? And there's, you know, all this evidence that points to the fact that God knows. So, you know, we have to affirm that, but to hold it to the extreme feels really quite unbiblical to me. Likewise, the idea that it all comes down to us, right? That it's all our choice. That it's only our choice, and that God basically stays out of our business apart from, you know, prompting or inviting or working around the edges of our life. I'm not sure that either Scripture allows that view, nor that it's particularly helpful for us to think that God is kind of on the edge of our lives and not particularly powerful and all that kind of stuff. Which does leave us in the position of saying we have to hold them in tension. You know, the Bible's answer, if I can put it this way, to this question is yes, right? Is God sovereign? Yes. Do we have to make real choices? Yes. Do those things make sense together? Not necessarily, but too bad. Because throughout Scripture, there's the emphasis on God's sovereignty, on his ability to choose and to set apart and to elect and all of those sorts of things. And to, you know, in cases like Pharaoh or Cyrus, use people who are outside of the people of God, who are not necessarily obedient or faithful, to demonstrate his glory. And at the same time, there's a strong theme that we are called to make decisions that have real consequences for us, and for those around us, that, you know, prayer matters and that our decisions matter and the way in which we live our lives matters. And so I think that the best way to, I'm not sure that we can reconcile them, I guess is what I'm saying. I think we have to hold them in tension somehow. And that can be a bit tricky, right? Because they kind of preclude each other, right? If God makes all the decisions, I have no choice. And if I have real legitimate choice, then I somehow undermine God's sovereign will, I guess. Now, you know, I think that there are ways in which theologians have sought to reconcile that by emphasizing one slightly more than the other while trying to hold them together. There's a reason why this is a vexed issue that keeps popping up, because it's not one that is easily solved or easily reconciled. I would fall on the both end, right? That we have to hold to both of those, which allows then for the opportunity to recognize and acknowledge God's sovereignty, but at the same time, really encourage genuine, real all discipleship, real decisions, real choices that I think are particularly helpful. So again, that's a brief summary of some of the things we've covered before and some of my opinions on it that I know I've expressed before, but I hope that it's helpful. I do think that Scripture often leads us into the both and, right? It kind of refuses to do the yes to one and no to the other. There seems to be a number of instances where we're told there's a little bit of both and you have to live with that. And that feels like the best way forward. My way of reconciling it is that, you know, I think I would start with God's sovereignty because that's a good place to start. But that in his sovereign will, he has invited us to make real decisions and that he has enabled us to make decisions that really matter. And therefore, that's really important for us. Paul says in Galatians 3:24 that the law is a schoolmaster that brings us to Christ. What is our correct use of the law according to Paul? And if I were really gonna answer this question well, I would give you a systematic approach to it, right? I would talk about the four or five different ways that Paul talks about the law. I'd explore the, I don't know, five or six metaphors that he uses for the law and those sorts of things. and that would be a valuable exercise. Paul's primary pastoral concern, right? Because the epistles that he writes are all pastoral documents. They are occasional pastoral documents. So there's an occasion that Paul has is writing them to, like a situation or a circumstance. And those issues that he's addressing, those occasions, are nearly always pastoral. He's trying to strengthen or to correct or to build up or to protect a group of believers. And that needs to be kept in mind, particularly when you consider that Paul's letters were written in the first generation of the Christian movement, in which one of the central issues was the one that we're exploring in our journey through Romans, which is the question of the Gentile inclusion and the heritage of the Jews. So on Sunday, I talked about the Jews and Gentiles who had placed their faith in Jesus being like a marriage in the sense they've formed a third family, but it wasn't a regular marriage between two equals. It was like the Gentiles had married into a royal family where there were all these expectations and assumptions and historical precedents and legal implications and all that sort of stuff that went with it. So it was far more complicated to navigate. And some of those things were things like the law and the scriptures and, what do you do with clean and unclean food and things like circumcision and the things that had set Jews apart. And what was the rule? At what point did they need to be incorporated by Gentile Christians and not? And I think that does color some of what Paul has to say about the law. And if I could summarize, I think, what Paul has to say about the law is that the law is good as long as it is used for the purpose that it is intended for. So I used the example on Sunday about the law being a little bit like a recipe. The point of a recipe is not to have the recipe. The point of the recipe is to, bake a cake, is the illustration I used, or, pick your favorite food, right? The recipe leads to and guides you to the cake. That's the purpose of the recipe. You can't eat the recipe. The recipe is not great storytelling. It's not a page turner, right? Like its function is very specific. And Paul, I think, would argue that the law is good as long as it's used for the purposes that it was originally given. And so the law was never given to create righteousness, nor was life found in it. Right? If you followed it like a recipe, it led to life, right? It led to righteousness, but it wasn't righteousness and it wasn't life in and of itself. And so I think a lot of what Paul has to say, even that idea of the law being a kind of a guardian until we came of age, right? Is really speaking about the law's proper use. Like thinking about the law properly, that the law was not the final outcome. It was there to guide us. So I think that the law, you think about it in the Old Testament context, the law was exactly that. And I think this is where the law continues to have value for believers today. That the law was a depiction, a portrait of what it looked like to live in relationship with God. It's still valuable for us today because the character of God doesn't change. And so while the circumstances and the and the situations addressed by the law might have changed, it nonetheless reflects the character of God. It reflects the values of God. It reflects the priorities of God and therefore becomes a really helpful source of reflection and in the cases of, like, say, the Ten Commandments, of obedience, because it reflects that so clearly. But that ultimately then is meant to point us to and this is where Paul talks about the law being negative, right? In the sense that it shows us how far we fall short, right? That's part of the role of the law. It's still good, right? It is still the recipes that we can follow to cake. But there are times when we don't follow the recipe perfectly. We don't follow it right, and the cake falls, or it doesn't taste right because we had the wrong ingredients, or whatever the case is. And so there are times when the law shows us how we have fallen short. That still doesn't mean the law is bad, right? But that's part of what the law has to do. So Paul's concern in the pastoral context that he was writing to was that the law would be utilized in the church in a way that it was never meant to be utilized, namely as a way to be saved. In the Old Testament, the language of salvation is not often spiritual. It's usually like really concrete and physical, right? I've been saved from my enemies, or I've been saved from this battle, or I've been saved from this illness, or I've been saved in the midst of drought, or I've been saved in some other trouble. Right? That's the salvation. The people of God were brought into a covenant with the Lord by His grace, and then the law was given as a description of what it ought to look like. And so when Paul is addressing questions of salvation, right? The law was never designed to bring people into a relationship with God. It was designed for those who were already in one. So I think all of those things kind of get played together. I said on Sunday that as Protestants, those who are not Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, we tend to put a great emphasis on faith alone. And we tend to then see faith alone as being kind of the polar opposite of the law and of works. And I don't think that that's how Paul saw the law. He obeyed the law. He called people to live up to the standards of holiness and righteousness that are contained in the law, but he didn't allow anyone to see the law as being the basis of inclusion. And that's part of what was happening in the early church. It seemed that the Jewish believers, I wouldn't say rightly so, but I think you can understand why they thought this, right? The Christian religion had had come from the Jewish faith and was very much a continuation, right? Which is why we had the Old Testament in our Bible, right? There's this continuation theme. And so there was this, a logical expectation that if people were going to come to faith in Jesus, that they would also embrace like the Jewish traditions that Jesus represented, that they would adopt the scriptures that Jesus had adopted, that they would, right, that they would kind of fit within that process, which meant then that they would become Jews first and then Christians. And Paul was adamant that that is not how people entered into the people of God. It was by faith. And so he had a tricky place to navigate. He wanted to affirm the law is good, and he does, but that the law had particular purposes that were different from salvation. It was never meant to save, and it couldn't save, and it couldn't bring life, as was evident in the history of Israel and all that sort of things. And it couldn't bring life now. And so that was the argument that Paul was really focused on. So I think, to answer the question, right, the correct use of the law is that the law is good as long as it is being used for the purposes for which it was given, which of course invites us to reflect more deeply on the purposes for which the law was given. But also I think helps us say that the law is a good thing. And just trying to focus on what the law was meant to do, and then apply that to our lives as best we can. So the third question is this: in today's context, how can we live our faith when we need to take into account the law? And as I said at the outset, I'm going to take this as being living out our faith in the context of the laws of the land, rather than the Mosaic law, because I don't know many Christians who grapple with whether or not they should obey the food laws of the Old Testament. So I'm assuming that that's where this question's going. If I've gotten that wrong, my apologies. You can ask again next week and I'll try to answer it properly and we'll go from there. And this is, I think, it's an interesting I wouldn't say a thought experiment, but it's a little bit of an application point for us in relationship to the question of law and faith. You know, we are called to live out our faith, and the ways in which we interact with the law of the land generally falls under a handful of categories, right? So there's a whole bunch of laws that I don't think as Christians we can really stand against on any kind of theological basis, right? You should wear your seatbelt. If you want to tell me that because you are a believer in Jesus, you don't have to, you're gonna have to push that rock uphill pretty hard. I think you're just being foolish if you don't adhere to that kind of a law, right? And I think there'd be lots of laws that we would appreciate as being for the general good of society, right? And that might include, you know, everything from, you know, seatbelt regulations to, you know, the regulations around keeping children safe or around taxation. Now, we might not always agree with the taxation policies of the day, but we understand that, you know, taxes are kind of what makes the whole thing work for us, and that sometimes I need to be put out in order that we as a society do better and all of those sorts of things. So there's a lot of those sorts of laws that I think we recognize the validity of. There are probably moral and philosophical implications for them, but we're pretty comfortable with them from the perspective of faith. And then there are the laws, and I think I'm guessing that this is where the question is really stemming from. There are those laws where, you know, particularly around religious freedoms, for instance, we might talk about freedom of speech and whatnot, where we feel like our religious rights or our ability to live out our faith is compromised by the laws. There's probably a couple things that I would say about this. First of all, I think sometimes there is a fair amount of fear-mongering amongst Christians that a law is going to do more damage and harm than it actually will. And so I think we have to be very careful about jumping to conclusions or clicking on the first story that we see about it and getting outraged. I think that's fairly important for us to pay attention to. I'm not saying that every reaction is an overreaction, but overreaction is what drives our social media atmosphere. And so we just need to be really aware of that. I think secondly, it's really helpful for us to acknowledge and to work hard to acknowledge, and again, this is in part the social media atmosphere in which we live, to acknowledge the benefit of the law and the reason why it has come into effect, right? The government is not interested in getting caned in the public over any kind of law, right? So if they are introducing new legislation, it's because they feel that the legislation is worth the political risk, right? There's enough support or enough rationale or reason behind it that they're going to do it even if it has political consequences. So I mentioned on Sunday the the legislation around e-safety, the e-safety commissioner, and seeking to create a safer environment for our kids by banning kids under 16 from having social media platforms and age verifications for like pornographic sites, and like there's a whole bunch of those things that are in there. And you know, the government, you know, made some really quick decisions about that based on some research, and you know, I'm not sure what the political outcomes of those are going to be, but they felt that it was important enough to do. And so I think it's really important for us to remember to recall and to focus on why did this come into effect. Right, I don't think that if I can flip it again, I don't think our political leaders are interested in persecuting Christians or restricting religious freedoms, but they're aware that there are some tendencies that could be really unhelpful. And so we have to address and acknowledge that. I think that's a really important step as well. So don't overreact to some legislation, and do try to pay attention. You know, like, you know, I think about the kids' safety, not the e-safety, but the safe church stuff that we now engage through. And you know what? It's a lot more work than it used to be. But the reason why it's a lot more work is because the church, amongst other institutions in our society, failed children. And so, you know what? This is legislation that we had to have. And so we cop it, right? And you get on board or you don't. And I think as Christians, we need to. In those circumstances, though, where we haven't overreacted and we understand and appreciate where the legislation may or may not be coming from, there are still some laws where we feel that we may be led to civil disobedience. I think that civil disobedience should never be violent. I think that there are lots of places where we have opportunity to respond. I mean, we do live in a democracy, so we can take things through the court system, for instance. We can challenge legislation. We can lobby governments for particular points of view and those sorts of things. And there will be times and places, perhaps, where we will have to be, where we feel led to be civilly disobedient. When that happens, we have to be very aware of what it is that we're doing and very careful about that. I think most of the time, in answer to the question, I think most of the time we can live our faith out with very little concern for the laws of the land. There are some laws that are a little bit restrictive, in parts of the country. And again, we need to be aware of kind of why that's been brought into legislation and kind of own some of that. But also, I think, we are still free to be Christians. We're still free to gather. We're still free to talk about our faith. We're still free to live our lives and to answer questions and all that kind of stuff. And we just need to be cautious, I think, in lots of instances. We are a long way from being persecuted or oppressed like many believers are around the world. And so I think we have to kind of hold those things in tension. So I hope that's helpful. It's kind of high level reflections on those sorts of things. I think in our current context, I think it's an important place to start. Continue to pray that the legislation that our governments pass are good for all people, whether they have faith or not. Places that, laws and legislation that we can live with and live within and be faithful to as we seek to follow Jesus. Thanks again for those of you who presented those questions. Hope the answers were helpful. This coming week, we're launching, basically, we'll look at the end of chapter 10 and the start of chapter 11. In Romans, we've got two more weeks in Romans before we have a bit of a break, particularly over the school holidays and whatnot. We'll get back into Romans in term 3. Hope you can join me on Sunday, whether it's on site or online. We'd love for you to be a part of our community of faith as we continue to figure out what it means to love and follow Jesus in order that we might see lives changed by him. Until next week, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big 3 podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.